have our wonderful technical challenge. You know, they have stories of the Buddha with gatherings of 500 people around him out in the forest. And they didn't have speakers back then. And maybe the Buddha didn't appear as this, you know, very quiet, serene kind of person. Neither, you know, this loud, booming voice that just kind of resonated through the forest. Okay, so I hope all that makes a difference now and helps out. Does the sound sound natural enough in the back? Yeah, I'm pleased with the way the sound sounds. Sometimes speakers, I hear a little echo or something. I just hear myself. So, let's see if I brought it here. I wanted to read a quote from the Discourses of the Buddha. So the story is that the Buddha goes out on his alms rounds in the morning. Every morning, Buddhist monastics will go out with their begging bowl, their alms bowl, in order to gather the food they need for that day. And so he's out wandering around, and he comes across a farmer who's out there plowing with his workers. And the Buddha walks by, and the farmer says, "You know, I work for my food. I work out really, really hard, and I plow, and I plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, I eat, then I eat. Do you likewise plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, eat?" So it's a little bit of a challenge, you know, this monastic who doesn't do anything but sit and meditate and teach. And then the Buddha says, "Oh, I also plow and sow, and having plowed and sown, eat." So then the farmer says, "Of course. You claim yourself to be a plowman? I see no plow. Tell me, O plowman, what kind of plowing is it you do?" So the Buddha replied, "Faith is the seed, and composure the rain. Clarity is my plow and yoke. Conscience is my guide pole, and my mind is the harness. Wakefulness is my plow blade and my goad. Well guarded in action and in speech and moderate in food, I use truth to weed and cultivate release. True effort is my oxen, drawing the plow steadily toward nirvana, freedom without regret. This is how I plow. It bears the deathless as its fruit. Whoever plows in this way will become free of all sorrow and distress." So the farmer said, "Let the venerable monk eat. You are indeed a plowman, and your plowing bears the fruit of freedom." So it's a nice quote for various reasons. One is that it mentions that the path of cultivation, the path of practice that the Buddha taught, involves many of our faculties, and so many different elements of our life harmonize and come together for the development of our inner life. But the first one is faith, which he calls here the seed that he's going to plant. And you plant the seed and then you tend it with your composure, with clarity as you develop through meditation, with a well-developed conscience, concerned about not hurting others or hurting yourself, and so forth. And faith is a very important element of the Buddhist path, the spiritual path. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time today talking about faith. When I was thinking about it yesterday as today's topic, it made me happy to think about it. I don't know how well I'll be able to convey my sense of joy or happiness around the topic. It's a topic which makes some Western audiences uncomfortable. Because, and you find some literature, Western literature, where they discuss Buddhism, where they very clearly want to call Buddhism scientific. And it doesn't involve any kind of faith. It doesn't want any kind of blind belief or any kind of superstition or supernatural belief in something. And people don't like faith, the word faith, that it has connotations in the West, maybe, which some people are trying to get away from when they come to do start a new Buddhist practice. And perhaps the word faith is not the best translation of the Buddhist word sadha. Some people prefer to use the word trust, some people conviction, some people confidence. And I think actually probably all those kind of fit in. The word sadha is kind of a broad and different context, it has different meanings. But I'm content enough with the word faith for myself, because faith has kind of is a very, very broad word, which doesn't seem to have any clear boundaries. And so the fact that faith is kind of beyond what maybe I can even understand, because it goes beyond what I can understand, and then maybe faith is the right word. Maybe not. So maybe some of you will be uncomfortable with this topic today. So faith is needed for, certainly needed for the path, and it gets born as a person practices, as one does mindfulness practice and develops themselves, that faith will naturally be born. But even before it naturally develops, a certain level of faith or trust needs to be present in order to even take the first steps. If you take an academic class at junior college nearby or something, or Stanford, there's a certain level of trust that you have that the City College or the Stanford University has, you know, chosen an instructor which warrants you paying a certain amount of money and showing up. And you show up with a certain level of trust, and maybe sometimes you're disappointed, but you show up with that trust. You grant institution a certain level of trust. You trust the instructor to some degree, that the instructor knows something that you don't know, and therefore the instructor can help you make decisions that you wouldn't know how to make yourself. They tell you what you're supposed to read. They tell you what kind of project you're supposed to do. And then you, because you trust that this is useful for your education, do those things. And education tends to be a lot more efficient if we can trust a few people who kind of survey the field and know what is most efficient and helpful to do. And of course, sometimes we're disappointed, and sometimes we go into these situations and kicking and screaming, and we do it for ulterior reasons. But I think there's a level of trust that's kind of built into much of our social interactions with each other. We trust the people on the road who drive, that they don't, that stay on their side of the street. Our dollar bill says we trust in God. It seems kind of very appropriate that that's where the trust should be, money. And I told the story enough, but when I was in Burma, most people kept their money in these denominations that were under 100 kyat notes. 100 kyat note was worth about $1.50. So people had stacks of these at home. They didn't trust the bank, so they kept them in the mattresses and stuff. And I woke up one morning to be told that the Burmese government had decided that all the bills from 100 kyat below were now worthless. They just canceled their value. And imagine you woke up tomorrow morning and they told you all your money. Well, here, most of us keep most of our money in the bank, I think, right? Not so many of us keep it in mattresses. But in Burma, they didn't trust the government. So a lot of them had the money at home. So we trust these things. There's a lot of trust that's built in. And to some degree, it can be a very small degree. You come to a situation, you read a book on Buddhism, and you trust what the person says, that you trust the book enough to think it's going to be interesting. You somehow you trust what's being said there enough you think maybe meditation's interesting. You encounter someone who gives instructions in meditation, you see that we're going to have a meditation class on Thursday, and some level of trust is implied if you're willing to come. And maybe you come, you know, with very open eyes and, you know, not so sure about whether you are going to trust it, but you're willing to give it a little bit of benefit of doubt initially, which is a kind of level of trust. So that's kind of a minimum kind of level that's required. I hope you understand what I'm saying. But But there can be greater degrees of that. And you can get great confidence in someone else. You meet someone else who's practiced longer than you have, and you feel inspired by them and feel confident in their presence, their practice. And that confidence translates as both an inspiration that maybe I can do this too, let me practice, and also perhaps a level of trust in that person. This person's worthy to listen to. Maybe this person has something to say, or maybe this person's advice is helpful in some ways. And without some level of trust, we hold ourselves back and not willing to engage in our own work. The famous quote, it says, the Buddha said, the Buddhas only show the way. You have to do the work yourself. So the spiritual work, the spiritual practice is something you have to engage in. But to have someone who can point the way, or someone to inspire you or give you some instructions and give you confidence, is often very, very helpful. I'm pretty confident myself that I couldn't have practiced myself without the support and the inspiration and the confidence that I got from the many people I was practicing with, and my teachers and senior students around when I was a new student. And some people hold themselves back. They don't want that. They've been burned before, and so they don't want to be burned again. They have been, they have a whole philosophy of some kind of individualism where they're supposed to stand on their own two feet and not let anyone else have any effect on their spiritual life. But I think to some degree, having confidence in oneself and trust in oneself can, in initial stages of practice, be reflected from another person. We see someone else and say, oh, that person's done it. That person is exhibiting some way of being that resonates in some way that I think I can be, or I would like to be, or maybe this offers some suggests a potential of mine if I enter into the same kind of practice or cultivate myself in the same way. And within reason, the greater degree of trust and confidence we develop in these kinds of ways, maybe the more inspiration and energy we'll apply ourselves to doing the practice. Some people hold themselves back a lot from practice. And one of the reasons is maybe they don't trust it. They have a lot of doubt. It seems kind of good on the surface, but they're not ready to kind of, you know, entrust themselves to something which they don't have more faith in that really works. And so they do a little bit, this nice little bit, and helps their life and brings them comfort. But they don't have faith of how far it can go. And to some degree, that's true for most of you, most of us, perhaps, that we have a lot of, I think most of you have practiced some, and you know that there's some benefits in doing a practice, and it has some inspiration, but perhaps you don't have a lot of confidence in the experience of awakening itself. The experience of nirvana is something that's possible for you to attain, and that's something that's worthwhile for you to attain, that's worthwhile throwing yourself into in a very serious way. And I'm not saying that's something everyone should do, but there's whole levels of degrees of confidence and inspiration that different people have. And part of the function of faith and trust is to encourage one to go beyond one's doubts and explore the spiritual path much beyond what one even... you know, to explore the full depths of it. So at some point, we start doing the practice. Mindfulness practice, concentration practices, the practices of compassion, loving kindness, the practice of the precepts of living a good life. And one of the ways of characterizing Buddhist practice is that can be characterized as staying true to our good heart. The Buddha talked a lot about the practice of restraint as being very key to Buddhist practice. But maybe in the Buddha's culture of his time, the word restraint had different connotations, associations than what it does for us in the modern West and here in California. And so I feel a little uncomfortable talking for myself using the word restraint. But I can talk about the same thing by talking about it staying true to my good heart. And it doesn't feel so constricting then. But staying true to my good heart. And the point here is that we no longer follow our impulses, our motivations of greed, hate, and delusion. You know, all the different versions of that. We all have these things. We have impulses of greed and desire, of wanting, of lust, of ambition. We have movements of aversion, of hate, and ill will. And you know, it's to some degree, maybe it's very minor sometimes, sometimes it's really great. And it isn't that we're supposed to be critical of this, our aversion to these things. Mindfulness, we see them and have tremendous compassion and a kind of acceptance of them. But we have a training not to follow them, not to kind of, you know, get on the bandwagon and say, okay, I'm going to really have myself a good hate session here now. You know, so we can see the anger arise, or the aversion arise, or the greed arise, and we see it wisely. And then we say, okay, rather than kind of getting on this bandwagon, I'm going to stay true to my true heart, to my good heart. So we don't follow these kind of what's considered unhealthy impulses. We don't follow these impulses, also described in Buddhism, as impulses which drain us. Even though initially we can get a lot of energy from them, and that's why some people kind of pursue them, is for the energy that's provided. Ultimately, they drain us. And their word is the drains that the Buddha had. So, as we do the practice of our kind of staying true to our good heart, there are different mental factors, different inner psychological factors, feelings or emotions, or Buddhist word is factors, that begin kind of becoming stronger or stand out or get cultivated. And these things are things like patience and calm and energy, greater understanding, wisdom, concentration. And one of these is also faith. And this is a little bit different, maybe understanding of faith, than the way we usually think of it. Because it's not faith in a creed or a belief. It's not necessarily faith in something else, but rather it seems to be something which, kind of almost like an emotion, that gets born out of the goodness of our heart as it gets stronger or shines more fully as we stay true to it. And it's connected to these other factors. And often when Buddha talked about faith, he didn't talk about it alone, but he talked about faith in relationship to other factors. Like he starts with, he talked about faith and patience, faith and calm, faith and virtue. Faith isn't necessarily something that stands on its own, but as the inner life is cultivated, it comes together with a number of different factors that are naturally born there from the practice. So what is this kind of faith as a mental factor? Over and over again, the associated word describing faith, or kind of connected to faith, the sister of faith, is the word called pasada. And pasada can be translated into English as tranquility or calm or peacefulness. Maybe peacefulness is a good word. And so the idea being that faith in Buddhism has a peaceful quality to it. I think we easily imagine or seen examples of faith where a certain kind of fire is connected to the faith. Evangelical fire, you know, it's, you know, go out and convert the world. But in Buddhism, the idea of faith is it's connected to a peacefulness. So that sense of kind of fiery faith, and maybe even blind belief then, is not necessarily present. So what gets cultivated maybe is maybe the word here is faith or trust, maybe a kind of confidence that gets born inside of us, and maybe kind of a sense of certainty, or a sense of goodness, or a sense of lightness, a sense of inspiration, kind of a buoyancy of the heart, a buoyancy of the mind that comes as we begin doing the practice itself. And I can feel in my own practice that the degree to I have a lot of faith, but my degree of faith wanes and waxes depending on how deeply I am into the practice. There are times when my meditation practice is quite deep, and other times when it's not somewhat shallow. And it kind of goes in ups and downs through the weeks and the months and years. And the deeper my concentration, the deeper and stronger my mindfulness and my calm, the greater the natural sense of inspiration and faith and kind of delight is there for me. And the more shallow it is, the less it's actually there. So it's a kind of faith that almost doesn't require an object to the faith. It's not like you have to believe in something. It's almost like a state of being. Of maybe confidence is a good word here. Or inspiration. But the Buddhism does talk about things that you can have faith in. The objects of faith. And I find it very interesting that the first item that the Buddha encouraged Buddhist practitioners to have faith in was... What do you think? If you can guess the right answer. What's your good Buddhist have faith in? Yourself? What? Meditation? The Dharma? That there's relief from suffering? What else? What do you have? The Four Noble Truths? The Sangha? What? Community? Practice. In some sense, you're all right. In some sense, you all missed it. And but the first thing that the Buddha encouraged people to have faith in is in karma. And karma here means cause and effect. That your actions have certain kind of effect. There are consequences to what you do. Now that is, you know. For most of us, that's, you know, something we've learned when we were 9 months old. It's a very basic thing in our development to learn cause and effect. You push the button and the little jack-in-the-box pops up. But what the Buddha was implying is that, teaching karma, is that the quality of the intention that motivates your action creates consequences that are very particular to the quality of that motivation. So, if I hit this bell with the intention to gently awaken you from your meditation so that you can continue feeling some peacefulness and mindfulness, that has a very different intention than if I say, you know, if I just kind of like, let's see if I can just kind of, you know, irritate these people. You know, just bang it. The quality of the intention has a huge impact on our psyche, on our soul, if we use a Western word. And for example, it reinforces certain habits. If we continually follow through on intentions which are filled with greed or hate, then we kind of reinforce those habits and it kind of creates a certain kind of character. If we continually follow through on qualities of love and compassion and generosity, then it creates a different kind of character over time. There's also what's called instant karma, and that is that if you're really sensitive, you can see that, for example, if you act on anger, that somehow, maybe you have to be very sensitive to see it, but you're suffering in the act of being angry. Yourself, even if you feel justified in being angry, there's a kind of suffering that's part of that. If you lie to someone, you're suffering because of that. There's suffering that's happened that allows you to lie. So that's called instant karma. But also there's delayed karma in the sense that there's effects of your actions that might be far down the line, and we don't know how far down the line they might appear. The Buddhist tradition. we'll talk about it occurring in many, future lifetimes. I don't know if we have to believe in that necessarily. The faith in karma has nothing to do necessarily with future lifetimes, but just what it has specifically to do with is that, and we're supposed to give us some confidence, is that we can begin training or choosing what we do with our hearts and minds that can help develop a wiser, more compassionate, and happier life. That we can develop the skills to watch our mind, to stay true to the good heart, to restrain ourselves from certain impulses which create negative karma, which have these deleterious effects, and that we can develop the good qualities and strengthen them. And in doing that, begin to create a kind of radiance of heart, a kind of delight and purity of heart, a kind of freedom of heart from doing that. And so the having some kind of faith in karma is not some faith in some metaphysical principle, but rather have some faith, and this is kind of like having faith in yourself, or faith in practice. Have some faith that you can make a difference in your life by how what you do with your heart and your mind, your impulses, where you rest your awareness, what you do. It's a lot more wholesome, for example, to rest in a kind of peacefulness of being than it is to rest in ambition and run around and be really busy. So a lot of, in the West, a lot of Buddhist teachers will talk a lot about the importance of a kind of a receptive, accepting awareness where we just allow ourselves to be and discover that we're just kind of complete and perfect just the way we are. We actually don't need to cultivate and develop ourselves. We just have to kind of just relax and let just be rather than do is a common kind of thing to discuss. I think because Westerners are such doers that they need to hear about being. But, our thing about this is that that's also something to do. And so you have to have some confidence that that's a good thing to do nothing, just to be. And you have to kind of remind yourself every few seconds, okay, I have to do the being. And you do that, and then you'll find some of these wonderful, the goodness of the heart will begin to become stronger for you. The other thing which the Buddha talked about we can have faith in, one of the aspects of karma is that, having faith in karma, is that we can't actually know the long-term, all the different consequences of our intentional acts. We can't know our unintentional acts either. It's kind of like ripples out from us into the cosmos. And there's some kind of feeling in Buddhism that we also have some faith that our actions have cosmic consequences. And we're intimately connected to the whole world. We're intimately connected to everyone and everything. And that our actions have effects in that wider world. And we can't necessarily know what they're going to be. But this is where the faith becomes maybe a little bit more superstitious or a little bit more, you can't prove it. And so, some people don't want to have faith that can't be proven. But it tends to come, I believe, a kind of faith that, my consequences will have effects beyond what I can see. And I think I want to be a custodian or caretaker of the wider world that I can't see also. And not just simply live in my own world and cause and effect right here. So to have some faith that my intentional acts have cosmic consequences, and I'll take some responsibility for that. The other faith is talked about is the faith in the triple gem, triple refuge: faith in the Buddha, faith in the Dharma, and faith in the Sangha. And I think there has to be some faith or confidence or trust in the Buddha, not as a person so much, but in the fact that he was awakened, that he discovered the possibility of awakening, of nirvana. Until someone has had that experience for themselves, it's an act of faith to believe it's possible. And on what basis are you going to have that faith? It's a little bit awkward. It's hard. You know, how are you going to, if you don't know something as important as the Buddha's awakening, how are you going to know whether this really exists or whether it's really something that's worth pursuing or something you can do? And I think that it requires a certain level of faith and trust, and each person is going to have to negotiate that issue for themselves. And then at some point, and this, you know, it doesn't do much good to tell you this, maybe, but at some point, the idea is that you're supposed to experience that for yourself. And then your faith becomes a verified faith. And you develop confidence in this, a conviction, you know that, oh, this is actually the case, that that you can have the experience of awakening. You can have the experience where the Four Noble Truths, which some person mentioned earlier, are really confirmed. The Four Noble Truths are confirmed in small steps all along the way. It's very easy to see to small degrees how the Four Noble Truths work. But to see how the Four Noble Truths, the full depth of implication, the full, to really follow through them completely, not just understand them, but to have the release, which is the Third Noble Truth, to have the complete release of all our suffering, and experience that peaceful state, the peaceful way of being, that is beyond all our drivenness, gives us this verified, really the complete, absolute verified conviction in the Four Noble Truths, in the Buddha's awakening. And one of the ways in which I've had faith in the Buddha, and that gives me a lot of inspiration, is that to some degree I've tasted the purity of the mind, possibility of a great purity of mind. But it's not something that this purity of mind which I've tasted is not something which I live by all the time. You know, my mind, you know, gets confused and all kinds of odd things happen in this mind of mine at times, various times. But how I see the Buddha is someone who has integrated that purity into their full being. So that, I don't know if it's actually possible to do that, but I hold up the image, the archetype of a Buddha, as it seems to me, since I've tasted it to some degree, it's like maybe, for example, this floor here, you know, is, we come in here one day, maybe it's just filthy, full of dust. And yeah, I don't believe it can ever be cleaned. No way. So I go home. And then I meet some person who says, yeah, you know, you should come and look at my linoleum floor of my house. I cleaned it. And I said, well, that person did it. Maybe I can come here and do it. So finally, you're going to do it, and you clean one of the tiles. And that gives you some sense, oh, you know, I can see how clean and pure that one tile is now that I cleaned that one tile. I know now that it's theoretically possible, at least, to clean all the tiles in this floor here, so they'll all be clean and shining. So it's kind of like that with my inspiration for the Buddha. Like he's someone, at least the archetype of it, is he's been able to clean the whole room. And maybe that's the case, maybe that actually happened to him. But it doesn't really matter to me too much whether he did it or not, all the room. The fact is that's a direction that's possible to go is enough for me. And I find great inspiration, the fact that, oh yeah, I can do more of this, you know, more and more. We'll see how far I get. So to have faith in the Buddha's awakening, to have faith in the Dharma is traditionally the Buddha's teaching. But more profoundly than having faith in the teaching, I think it means to have faith in the practice. And this is also a place where I have tremendous faith. And it's kind of a faith which keeps getting strengthened all the time over the years and years that I've practiced, because the faith has so much, the practice has so much fruit, and it offers such tremendous protection in my life from all kinds of foolish impulses and all kinds of misunderstandings in life you know, it borders almost on because again the fruit of practice the chain of cause and effect is unseen sometimes. It's almost as if I'm willing to be superstitious about how it works. There's a saying in Buddhism that says, those who trust the practice are protected by the practice, or those who engage in the practice are protected by the practice. And I've seen over and over again in my life, when I had a fork in my life between doing something, following practice, following some opportunity to practice, versus doing something else, in the worldly terms, it was foolish to follow the practice choice. But every time, it worked great, much greater than, you know. So for example, when I went to Japan to practice, I showed up with almost no money. And, you know, when you don't have any money, one of the responsible things is to try to find work and, you know, get a little bit of money under your belt. Literally, back when I was traveling in Asia, that's where I kept it. And so I set up myself to teach English in Japan, which is what Westerners often do. But my teaching job was going to start in a couple of weeks, so I went to a monastery to sit a retreat. And the last day of the retreat, I said, what am I doing? I came to Japan to practice. I don't want to go and teach English. I came to do more serious practice. I know it's financially irresponsible of me. I don't know if I can do it. But I'm just going to trust the practice and see what happens. And so I did, and I had a glorious time practicing in Asia for that year. And in fact, I returned end of the year with slightly more money than I came with, without having to work. It wasn't much more, maybe it was like $60 rather than $50 or something. So, you know, maybe that kind of story is not so interesting for some of you, but to trust the practice, to trust that we can bring an open presence to whatever happens in our experience. And that open presence is a protection in that experience. And in particular, and where it's easy to see where the faith can reside, is we can learn through practice that the practice protects us from ourselves. And this is really, if you really understand the Four Noble Truths, that you really, really understand that the cause of our suffering, not our pain and our problems in our life, but our suffering, is in something that we choose to do in our minds. We choose to relate and react to events in a particular way that causes contraction. Or we can choose to relate to events that doesn't cause contraction. And as we develop our practice, we learn increasing skill and ability to not add to our suffering, to meet an event without suffering with it, and to have tremendous faith and inspiration and confidence in our ability to meet anything in life that occurs to us. And it might be very uncomfortable, but we ourselves don't add anything to it in terms of our unhealthy reactivity. And that, to me, I think for me, is the core, one of the core areas of confidence that I have in Dharma practice, in the Dharma. And then there's confidence in the Sangha, in the community, which some people mentioned also. Traditionally, this means to have confidence in the community of people who have witnessed for themselves a possibility of awakening. And it said that's where it should be, because the people who haven't witnessed the possibility of awakening haven't developed a certain purity, and they can make a lot of mistakes still. So if you put your faith in a community which is undeveloped, you might get burned in some ways. And a lot of Buddhists in America have been burned to some degree by their communities. But even so, I think a lot of us are inspired and get a lot of confidence from our fellow practitioners. And I know that many of the people that I practiced with had not tasted awakening, but the fact that their sincerity of practice was so strong, so evident to me. In fact, they were such powerful mirrors for me in my own practice, gave me a lot of confidence in a community of practitioners. It supported me and inspired me to a great degree. So it provided me with a lot of faith. And these different sources of faith in karma, in Buddha and awakening, in the teaching and in the practice, and in the community, sooner or later will become important for you, because it's very common in the spiritual practice to have times and experiences of doubt. To have times we feel a lot of doubt in our ability, doubt in the practice, doubt in all kinds of doubt. And it's useful to have reflected a little bit about what gives us faith, what inspires us, so that in times of doubt, we might call on those to get us through the particularly dark periods where that they inevitably will occur. So that's my thoughts this morning about the topic of faith. And I'm curious how you respond to that, react to that, and your questions, comments. Yes?
Is the opposite of faith fear or doubt or both?
She asked what's the opposite of faith, and she's wondering if it was doubt or fear or both. I think it's fine. Maybe there's a whole series of things which can be considered opposites of faith. The Buddha talked about faithlessness as being the opposite of faith. We cultivate it a lot from our own experience. So if we have enough faith to do the practice and engage ourselves in the practice, one of the functions of faith is to give us the energy or the inspiration to engage ourselves in the practice. And then once we engage ourselves in the practice, it feeds back to faith and strengthens faith. So, and then we, you know, it's like that. So that's one way of strengthening faith. Another way of strengthening faith is how I ended my talk, by saying to reflect on what brings you faith and inspiration. And any wholesome thing which you spend time appreciating tends to strengthen that wholesome quality. So if you actually give yourself some time to appreciate faith or what you have faith in. So traditionally in Buddhism, in all schools of Buddhism, and it's very common on a daily basis to do almost a little ritual to remind yourself of what brings you faith. People will chant the Triple Refuge. People will chant various descriptions of the Buddha, descriptions of the Dharma and practice, descriptions of the Sangha, or of awakening, as a way of bringing faith. Some people have an altar with a Buddha and they offer a flower on it. And those are all kind of devotional activities, and devotional activities tend to strengthen the faith factor for people. In our Western, our semi-secular Vipassana movement in America, we don't do a lot of these things. And maybe it's unfortunate that we can do more of that. And it's a very important part of the spiritual life is to have some of that. In Southeast Asia and Theravada countries, one of the common instructions you're given is not just sit down and start your mindfulness practice cold, but to spend the first 5 or 10 minutes of your mindfulness meditation doing something which is more faith-based, devotional-based. Maybe chanting, doing a little chant, taking the refuges, reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha or qualities of the Dharma. So all kinds of ways are cultivated just directly that way. One of the ways, of course, which is very important for Vipassana students in particular, is Vipassana practice functions very much on the principle that rather than pursuing an ideal, in Vipassana practice we pursue what keeps us from the ideal. And so rather than going into the great big door of faith, we go into the little door on the side of fear. And let's go into that fear. And then once the fear or the doubt has been resolved, then you find that actually was, you a more powerful door, a more important door into whatever the other side of that door. Yes, Ellen. It's beautiful, and each of you are welcome to translate the word sada in whatever English word you know works for you. If I use the word faith, then every time you hear me say faith, just erase it in your mind, fill in conviction. Yeah. Exactly. For me also. Yes, Jim.
One of the challenges of faith for me is that so many times stories about faith are stories about winners. And like Joan of Arc, as long as her forces were winning, people believed in faith. But then, at some point, her fortune changed. And she believed in her voices. So the question for me is, who had faith at that point, and what is the interaction of faith and reality? It's hard for me to understand, because it seems like, in retrospect, you can always say, oh, well, we had faith and so we won the game.
Yeah, it works that way sometimes. I think it was William James who said, made the example, if you have to jump over a gully, a really big, or something, and it's a really big jump, and you kind of wonder, can I really do that? The people who have faith are going to make it more likely than the people who don't have faith. Faith provides a little extra oomph, maybe energy or inspiration or a sense of possibility. One person did it, then a lot of other people could do it. They had the faith then that it can be done. And so there's an element in which faith actually can has beneficial consequences. And even if the faith is completely misguided, it can still have great, wonderful consequences. People who have faith tend to stay healthier, apparently. Certain studies that people have made. And it doesn't particularly matter what you have faith in for the health benefits. Yes. Oh. Knowledge. So we can follow the trail of our inner knowing, or follow the trail of the goodness of our heart, and just let it grow and grow and grow. Just follow it as it grows, and it becomes a very straightforward path. That way, it can be. To believe in something you don't understand. Sorry.
Two of the last comments related to Christianity, one way or another. And I realized, surprisingly, how instead of feeling a difference, I really feel a joy in the interconnectedness that we speak of part of the first rule. But there's really something exquisite about the bells and the chimes. At the same time, different people sitting beginning of the morning and talking about suffering one week and the day of the next.
It's interesting that I believe that people of different religions can meet at the place, at the sense, the inner sense of faith, or the inner sense of the goodness of the heart, or the purity of the heart that's being developed from whatever their beliefs are, that they have a lot of commonality. And when I involve in kind of interreligious dialogue or something, I'm really delighted by this meaning of that. Sometimes I find it a little bit hard when I meet at the level of Buddhist doctrine or Christian doctrine or whatever. There's so much of it I just can't make any sense of. But if I go below that to what's being born in their hearts, I can be really inspired.
Unfortunately for me, the trouble subsided. They jumping over gullies is thinking about consequences and crusades.
If I may, one comment about that. The Buddha, one of the lists the Buddha talked about, one of the really important lists for practice is the five faculties. And the five faculties are, starts with faith, and then it's energy or effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And the teaching is that the wisdom is supposed to balance the faith, and the faith is supposed to balance the wisdom. Did you hear the difference?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I see. I think a very good book that for the Vipassana community, which goes into some detail, with enough detail in relationship to the practice itself, is called Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. And it's by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. They alternate chapters. And a lot of these different things are touched on there. It's a kind of book that you want to maybe read slowly and kind of study. Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. So it also coincidentally happens that in that last week I talked about suffering and today faith, that one of the sources of faith is in responding to our suffering. There's a wonderful list, Buddha always lists, that describes the course of practice, and you start with your suffering. And the first thing that comes is faith or confidence or trust. And from there comes joy. And from the joy comes your concentration. And from your concentration comes contentment. And from contentment comes the ability to see clearly what's up. And when you can see clearly, then you can become free. Something like that. So it's a little bit longer list than that. So thank you all for listening, and I wish you a wonderful week.